Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 16th of January 2012 here in Japan, the 15th of January 2012 back in Canada, where I'm joined on the line by Andrew Gavin Marshall, a writer, researcher, essayist, author, and thinker who has been concentrating deeply on matters of institutional enslavement and all sorts of different issues at AndrewGavinMarshall.com. He's also the author of a forthcoming book at ThePeople'sBookProject.com, and now the host of a new weekly podcast at Sibel Edmonds Boiling Frogs Post.com entitled Empire, Power, and People. So, Andrew Gavin Marshall, always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having me once again.
All right. Well, I'm excited to talk with you today because we have been going over a very broad subject for the last couple of weeks here at CorbettReport.com, the subject of the police state. And it is such a broad a topic that one of the problems is definition. As always, many people define this in different ways and approach it from different angles. So perhaps we can start by getting your take on what constitutes a police state and what it is that we're really dealing with when we ask that question.
Sure. It's been called a number of things. A very common term for it is national security state. But as you said, police state is a very general term. Essentially, what it implies is the state taking over civil society in a great sense. The monitoring of the population. It's essentially about behavior and social control of the population itself, and how a state goes about implementing these measures or constructing a police state differs according to the state, its ideology, the time and place, and most especially the technology made available. So you see, historically, you can see aspects of a police state in the Napoleonic era, most especially with Hitler and Nazism, Stalinism. And up until today, you see, well, throughout the 60s, you know, we saw the national security states in Latin America, starting with Brazil in 1964 with the U.S.-supported coup. Very often, they have the military being in a very strong, if not predominant, role in society, where the military may even be in control of the entire country, a military junta or coup or regime or whatever you call it. The military tends to be very active in the construction, implementation, and maintenance of police states because very often it's about policing the population. And the military is the most effective tool in the policing and control of the population precisely because of its use as an apparatus of terror, and which is the fundamental basis for the concept of the police state. It's essentially a terror state. It relies on fear, intimidation, and coercion.
Well, that's exactly right in that assessment. And I think that's interesting because a lot of people from in the Western democracies and the so-called free world, when they think of the image of the police state, I think most of them do tend to think of military juntas and banana republics and other manifestations of that. But what I'm particularly interested in recent weeks has been exploring the ways in which the United States has become something of a police state and has manifested that power in slightly different ways than we would come to expect with that image. And also I'm interested in expanding that out into the other Western democracies, Canada, Australia, Japan. So what do you think about different ways that the police state can be something that's not quite as apparent as the boots on the ground military junta that you described?
Well, I think that this fundamentally comes down to technology and the advances made in technology. The difference between the military juntas, whether they're in Latin America or Asia or Africa, and the technological police state that we see developing today is the access to advanced methods and techniques of control. So the military regimes typically rely upon absolute coercion, police forces, military forces, etc., infiltrators, intelligence operatives, what have you. The difference between that and the modern police state, which is developing, like you said, not only on a national scale in the United States, but a transnational scale, is the access to and development of high technology methods of control. So you see the uses of computer, internet surveillance, CCTV, closed circuit television cameras, intelligence sharing, major government databases on all the information you could possibly imagine, you know, from your purchases at banks, companies, stores, your student records, every website visited, email sent, phone call made, tracking devices in phones, GPS technology. Technology has facilitated a totally new paradigm of police state abilities to emerge and control. And if I may just briefly give a quote from Zbigniew Brzezinski in his 1970 book, Between Two Ages, he actually discussed this issue. And this is before a lot of this technology was even available. He stated, keep in mind, this is 1970, that another threat, less overt but no less basic, confronts liberal democracy. More directly linked to the impact of technology, it involves the gradual appearance of a more controlled and directed society. Such a society would be dominated by an elite whose claim to political power would rest on allegedly superior scientific know-how. Unhindered by the restraints of traditional liberal values, this elite would not hesitate to achieve its political ends by using the latest modern techniques for influencing public behavior and keeping society under close surveillance and control. Persisting social crisis, the emergence of a charismatic personality, and the exploitation of mass media to obtain public confidence would be the stepping stones in the piecemeal transformation of the United States into a highly controlled society. And there you have it from one of the most prominent political strategists in the past 50 years.
Well, I think an interesting aspect of this that you bring up there is that if it is the high technology that is instituting a type of police state by default or de facto, then it's interesting to look at the way that that's internationalized by the multinational corporations behind the institution of the technology. So whether that is the institution of backdoors for cell phones or other portable devices that have been instituted at the legislative level in the U.S., or whether it's something like a DNA database, which is being put together by police forces in the UK and the United States and Australia seemingly simultaneously, whether or not that's a coordinated agenda or whether it's just simply a manifestation of the technology, the point is that it's sort of an international grid that's being created at the same time.
Yeah, and it's both. It's a coordinated agenda, and it's also the idea that if you build it, they will come. If the technology exists, it will be used in these purposes, because that's just the natural inclination of states, which are not interested in, you know, welfare or social well-being or public uplift. That's the rhetoric of modern states. The interests of states are in control and domination and expansion. And so long as the technology is developed and exists, it will be steered in these directions, almost just a natural inclination of power structures that exist. And it's not simply the states, but even the institutional power structures within and around society. If you look at the history of foundations in funding science and technology in the United States, you know, you have the Rockefeller Foundation, which funded a lot of the technology in the scientific field, which led to the creation of the atomic bomb. After World War II, their interest in science progressed into technology and other avenues. And of course, these institutions are concerned with power, with control, and with social engineering. So they also steer these developments into directions which benefit power structures instead of liberating people from power structures. Even President Eisenhower, in his farewell address in 1961, he not only warned about the military-industrial complex taking over democracy, but he also warned in a less quoted part of his speech about the possibility of a scientific technological elite coming to dominate the United States and elsewhere as well. And this was as a result of the changes in the scientific world that he was observing from his position within an extremely powerful institution of power and at the head of that institution. And he was observing that, in fact, this was a social transformation that was taking place, which even he as the president had no control over, or at least had no potential to deter this transformation from taking place. And as you said, it's very much internationalizing in scale. And we can see that it's being purposely directed in that sense. You see, a couple years ago, there was a plan put in place between the European Union and the United States to begin by 2014 a major database sharing agreement between the two blocks, essentially state blocks. The European Union is also sharing databases and intelligence with the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom is also a very interesting case because it's the most advanced surveillance society on Earth. It really sets the trends for what other technologically advanced societies are capable of and what they will implement. In the United Kingdom, as of 3 years ago, there were 4.2 million CCTV cameras. That's roughly one camera for every 14 people. Compare that to police state China, where there was one camera for every 472,000 people. So the technology is more advanced in the Western industrialized, technologically advanced states. And so it's being implemented within these states faster and with more effect than in even other major established police states around the world. And they're sharing that technology, expanding the technology, and integrating it. And this is also representative of the other political, social, and economic changes we see taking place in the world. As you see the process of regionalism unfolding, the European Union is the best example of this, as this process was undergone for half a century since the end of World War II, essentially, where you expand national governance into regional governance. That's not the end of the nation state, it's the expansion of the nation state into what are called supranational or above the nation concepts of continental super states. And you see this also in North America developing a little slower. It's run into setbacks from the documents from think tanks and government reports, and WikiLeaks released some cables related to North American integration. They had hoped that we would have established a North American community, much like the European community before the European Union, but they had hoped that we would have established this by the year 2010. So they're falling behind schedule, but it's still progressing, it's still advancing. And the technology sharing, the information sharing between states and intelligence agencies and, like you mentioned, corporations, is advancing along these lines. WikiLeaks also released a major compilation of records on the surveillance industry and on corporations involved in the surveillance and the abilities of corporations to monitor not simply transactions, but just essentially social existence among the population and transfer that information to governments in the corporatist model between state and corporate entities. You know, as Mussolini defined it, fascism should more properly be called corporatism because it's the merger of state and corporate power. This is no less symbolic in the uses and expansion of technology and surveillance equipment that's being made available and continued to be made available. Even the National Intelligence Council of the United States, which oversees the 16 intelligence agencies in America, yes, there are 16 intelligence agencies, they release trend reports looking at general global social, economic, political, technological, scientific trends over however many decades into the future. In 2008, they released a report looking up to the year 2025, where they said that democracy is in decline everywhere, economic crises will persist, leading to a legitimacy crisis for even established democracies, which is a euphemism for America and the West. They also said that surveillance technology will expand, control over the populations will be made more effective, you'll see gated communities arising within societies, protecting the elite from the threats within the population. If you even look at the legislation and the commissions that led to the establishment of the Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security in the United States, that predated 9/11, first of all. 9/11 was the excuse to create the Department of Homeland Security. But it actually goes back to 1998 when Bill Clinton established a commission to look at security challenges in the 21st century. They came out with three major reports, one of them in 1999, the other in 2000, and the last in 2001. In it, they recommended the creation of the Homeland, of the Department of Homeland Security. They also discussed reasons why such an institution would be required. And they stated quite bluntly that for most advanced states, major threats to national security will broaden beyond the purely military, meaning, and they went on, serious and unexpected economic downturns, major disparities of wealth, labor and social disruptions. So they identified domestic threats as a result from the inherently segregationist and exploitative social, political, and economic structure that we live in. And the recommendation then was to create a homeland security state. And a homeland security is, it's a very Orwellian term, because it's always sold and pushed forward on the basis of protecting the people from terrorism or communism or whatever boogeyman you want to create. But in fact, the intention and the purpose of the Homeland Security State or the National Security State is to protect the elite from the people. And so it's directed towards control, domination, and surveillance. And of course, you know, there's been several psychological studies on the concept of surveillance and observation. And it's well known that, and this is very well known to social planners especially, that people, when they know they're being watched, alter their behavior in ways that would be acceptable to those who are watching. So if the concept, it's not exactly a secret that the police state surveillance society is being constructed. It's done slowly so that people don't notice it that much, so that they don't protest against it that much. But the technology being implemented is being discussed publicly. And people are aware that there's more cameras around, that there's, in Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver, the three largest cities in Canada, over the past several years, surveillance cameras have been put into all the transit systems, on the buses, on the subway, metro, SkyTrain, expanded all around the area. In Vancouver for the Olympics, they immensely expanded the surveillance of downtown Vancouver. And of course, they said it would be temporary, but then after they changed their mind and said, actually, it's going to be permanent, they'll just stick around. And so people know that there's cameras around, it's hard not to see them. And people can actually alter their behavior. And if you look at the United Kingdom, which again sets the trends, so in several years we'll likely be seeing some of these techniques coming to the United States and then to Canada and elsewhere. They actually have voice boxes attached to surveillance cameras and other equipment, so that not only do the cameras watch you, but voices will come out of the speaker boxes, which tell you to, for example, pick up that litter you just dropped. Again, it's all regulation of behavior. And what's more is that they introduced this technology using children's voices. And they even had auditions at schools and programs aimed at schools to get kids to design posters for how to, you know, encourage people to monitor their own behavior, how to pressure children to use what was referred to as their pester power, to encourage adults to use better behavior. And because, of course, in any police state in history, you just look, especially in the 20th century, any police state, totalitarian society, the children are essential in coming under the control of the state to convince the population to be used as tools of the state against the families, communities, etc. Children always have to be brought in very early. And so schools are great socializing institutions for surveillance and control, because schools are largely based upon these principles themselves. You just look at the totalitarian structure of the classroom itself. And children are socialized from a very early age to participate and to be sort of agents of this system. You know, even you just look at like the notion of a hall monitor, you know, in a elementary school. It's and this expands throughout the whole society, and children are always sort of used as agents of manipulation, to manipulate the adults and the family structures. And this is, largely put forward in Britain as sort of the petri dish experiment of the modern police state. But sure enough, it'll come across the Atlantic.
Well, that's an important point that I'd like to pick up on, because I think it's important to understand the spread of these ideas that that take place in any particular polity tends to spread very easily across to another another democracy or what have you. And we often think of that in terms of the United States leading the way for the Western world. So, for example, when the United States implemented their biometric screening for passengers coming into the U.S. From other countries back in 2004, I believe, it was very shortly thereafter that Japan decided to implement that in their own way. So for example, we see that type of spread of program from one country to another. But I think it's also important to understand that it goes both ways. It's not just from America. So, for example, as you point out, the surveillance state is highly advanced in the UK. And you point out the example of the cameras that talk back. Well, now that is being rolled out in the US by a company that's putting out, I believe, a product called IntelliStreets, which is a lamp post that can talk back to people, and it's being funded by the Department of Homeland Security. No surprise there. So we see this kind of give and take. So to what extent is this spread, the internationalization of police state measures, a type of lowest common denominator or race to the bottom?
Well, it's essentially taking the processes, the technological revolution that has facilitated the process of globalization, and it's transferring this into the globalization of totalitarianism. The police state can facilitate this type of control of society. And so long as that temptation is there, states will adhere to it. And is sort of a race to the bottom, I guess, is what you were insinuating. And indeed, like from the perspective of civil liberties, freedoms, rights, individual expression, and general human rights, this is a race to the bottom. And this is very obvious in all Western states. You see increasingly since 9/11 legislation being passed. You know, the most famous, of course, is the Patriot Act. But we have our respective acts in Canada. There's in Australia, in the United Kingdom, in the European Union, all aimed at sort of slowly eroding and dismantling civil liberties, rights, and protections. And this is a response to not only the technology that's being changed and created and expanded, but it's a response to the social environment, the global social environment that we live in, where it's no longer, I mean, this is very evident with the economic crisis, it's no longer accepted wisdom that we can maintain these bloated, indebted middle classes in Western society. So essentially the bubble over the next decade, years, will be bursting, and you'll see a gross expansion of poverty, inequality. This is what the Citigroup document in 2005 referred to as plutonomies. And it identified the United States, Canada, Great Britain, and Australia as plutonomies, where you have a very rich who consume most of everything, and then you have everybody else. So already in 2005, Citigroup was saying that the middle class is basically an illusion, which it is. It's a debt-based class, and it's vanishing. And they no longer have the desire to sustain this class, nor the means to sustain it any longer. And so in these types of situations, you tend to have massive social unrest, social upheavals, rebellion, riots. You just look at the United Kingdom riots that took place not too long ago. You look at the Occupy Wall Street movement. You look at the Arab uprisings. I mean, regardless of other factors at play in these situations, there is a growing sense of global social unrest. In 2007, the United Kingdom actually issued a Ministry of Defense report looking at the future decades of the world, and it stated right in there that the middle classes of the world will likely become a revolutionary class. And so the social planners are not unaware of these developments that are taking place in society and will continue to advance. And so the police state technology is not simply a race to the bottom in terms of our liberties and our freedoms and rights, but it's a race to the top for the elite in terms of maintaining their dominance, maintaining their control,
and their power.
Well, then finally, is there any sense in which, if it is true that this police state is being enabled through technology, is there a sense in which the technology might enable the resistance to that police state as well? I mean, are there technologies that can be liberating for the oppressed classes, or is it simply a tool of oppression?
Well, of course, there's always that inherent balance with anything in life. It just so often seems that the good sort of lags behind the bad. So the technology is available. While we have the technology of control, we simultaneously have the technology of communication and information, which is in itself a liberating force. And that is one way that we are able to actually have this conversation and discuss these changes themselves, which is part of that struggle for liberation. And there's also the technologies being developed at various universities for getting around, say, control by states and these other type of things. So the technology is there. It's not being funded, obviously, because money is going into the technologies of control and domination. But as the system sort of advances in that direction, there will be increased pressure to move in the direction of using technology to advance the cause of liberation.
All right, a fascinating subject, but I think that's all the time we have for it today. So Andrew Gavin Marshall, thank you once again for your time.
Thanks for having me.